Hi everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Product Marketing Insider podcast. I'm Lawrence Chapman, and I'm the CD copywriter here at Product Marketing Alliance. As product marketers, we know the power of personalization. We also know how much work goes into building out effective demos. We've all worked cross-functionally, wrangling cats from product management, customer success, solutions consulting, sales, marketing and creative alike, to try and develop that end-all, be-all, perfectly recorded demo. From setting up demo environments, to developing a resonant narrative, ensuring the right contributors have the right screen recording software, access and aspect ratios, demo development can be a cumbersome initiative. And then of course, once you've made that last cut, you'll be informed by product design that a new UI update is going to be rolling out in the next quarter. We know it's better to show than tell. And we also know how important demos are in helping our prospects and customers truly see themselves in our products. They need to see how our solution can help them in their own jobs to be done. In today's episode of Product Marketing Insider, we're going to tune into a conversation between two storytelling enthusiasts, Chris Lynch, Chief Marketing Officer of Mindtickle, and Mike Mieduski, presentation designer and founder of Ghost Rash Communications. They'll share some of the more creative ways they've collaborated to build more engaging, story-driven demo presentations that work for the big stage, as well as the day-to-day sales enablement environment. Let's hear Mike and Chris make the case for building composability and personalization into the demos we create by leveraging tools we already have, PowerPoint and Google Slides. We'll also hear the couple discuss some of their favorite ways for us to make more memorable, effective, and scalable product demos.
All righty, welcome to Product Marketing Insider. This is Mike Mieduski, and I'm here with a very special guest, a chief marketing officer who has a profound love, I'd say, for product marketing. So, Chris Lynch, the CMO of Mindtickle. Chris, welcome to the Product Marketing Insider.
Mikey, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. And I think it'll be important to for everybody to get to know you a little bit and hear about your background. So curious how you got into marketing in general.
It was pretty accidental. I never throughout school, college, ever sat around and said, I want to be a marketer at a business. In fact, I started in journalism. I went to journalism school and did an internship for a company called the International Data Group. They owned a variety of technology and business publications at the time based out of Massachusetts. And not long after I graduated, they were saying, hey, let's let you go out to California and cover some of the new tech companies that were coming about then. And at the time, Facebook had been around for a few years. Like, it had just sort of made the move from an at edu thing to being more open broadly to the entire internet. Google was established, but not even at the level that you could consider it at today. And I moved out to California and really started getting embedded within the technology community. Got pretty close to a founder of a business, this gentleman named Ross Mayfield, who had started a company called Social Text, and he offered me my first marketing manager job. And, you know, at the time as a journalist in California, in San Francisco specifically, I didn't have two nickels to rub together at the time, and a marketing role sounded pretty good. And so I took it, and lo and behold, all these years later, I'm a CMO.
Yeah. How long did you spend out in the Bay Area?
I guess it would have been about 15 years all in.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's funny because I was trying to do the math and it's like coming up on darn near a decade that I've been lucky enough to be able to work with you. And we've collaborated on some pretty high stakes presentations over the years. And what's really hit me always and stood out to me about you, and maybe it's because you have that background in journalism and, you know, like fundamentally storytelling, but you've always been one of our partners and clients who really takes presentations seriously. And I mean, like, you sweat the details, you sketch out whiteboard stuff, you love the collaborative, you know, like spirit and bringing those ideas to life in a way that you truly envisioned, you know, even like sweating down to the last, like the click build, you know. I think it's always stood out that that really matters to you. And I'd love to just see if you want to go into that at all. Like, what is it about presentations that gets you so charged up and motivated to make sure that they go off right?
I think that presentations offer a very unique opportunity for storytellers, and particularly storytellers that work in business. You know, a lot of artists or writers will often get very hung up on the idea. In fact, it's in certain cases, I think, ruins some good artists' careers because they can't get over this idea that everything's already been said or everything's already been done, right? It really kind of drives people kind of crazy to think that, okay, if I wanted to go and write a poem or a novel or a short story, or I want to go and paint this thing that potentially somewhere that's already been done in some capacity. And when I think about business, if you're in a more mature market, I've generally worked in more mature markets, there probably are only so many ideas that are truly original, that are truly have never been told before. And when I look at presentations, it offers me an opportunity to convey what I think one of those ideas might be. Or if I'm working in some context where I do feel like even the ideas are kind of commoditized, then I view presentations as an opportunity to tell the story in a more compelling and interesting way than the other guys are. Because that's the other thing. I mean, I've always also worked in markets. When you met me when I was at Oracle, right? I was primarily competing with Salesforce and Adobe. And when we were building out products, we might have a product that they didn't have 1 month, they'd go and build it, and vice versa. We just keep playing leapfrog and catch up back and forth. So at a certain point, the way you told a story and your ability to make that memorable was one of your best levers you had to pull as a marketer. So for me, that is why I love presentations, is that it either allows me to convey an original idea in a way that's never been done before, or if it's a more well-accepted idea, it's an opportunity to get people to rethink how we look at that concept and truly walk away inspired and wanting to change or do something different with what they're doing. And in my case, that's been in business. But I think with presentations that you see all over the world, right, the advent and the rise of TED Talks and all of that is like probably another example where, you know, the ability to get up and present to people, maybe sometimes without slides, but in my case, I really enjoy the visual medium of presentations because I think it can complement what you're saying versus, you know, when done poorly, it's a distraction.
Right. You came up through product marketing and rose all the way now to chief marketing officer. Now you're probably crafting your own presentations more often. How is it different when you're writing for yourself to go give a pitch versus when you have to think about how it's going to be delivered by a whole field of others? What are the considerations like you have to take to account for that?
Yeah, great question. So one of the more popular safe things to say to people when you're giving advice about presentations is that everything should be incredibly minimalist, no more than a few bullets or a few words on a slide, keep them highly visual. I think for certain presenters, that's absolutely true. People that command a stage well, I think people that just have a natural knack for getting up and talking and communicating to people. Those are the types of people, by the way, that I feel like half the time they wouldn't need slides. Like right. They could just get up and say something interesting. I think for me personally, I went on a journey around public speaking. I was actually terrified of it early on in my career. I would get incredibly nervous, would end up memorizing lots of things and doing a lot of these things that we all know to be no-nos in your overall ability to go and present. So for me personally, over time, I've gotten more comfortable, and we could talk about, you know, that process a little bit, the creative process of how I write a presentation. But so for me personally on a main stage, yeah, a more minimalist approach makes more sense to me now than it did, say, 10 years ago, because I, for better or worse, don't get as nervous anymore when I get up and present in front of people. But when I'm building presentations for other people, i.e. a sales team, there is a different set of considerations. And in a lot of cases, I've ignored all the books, the blog posts, et cetera, about what great storytelling looks like, because I think there's some things that fundamentally, depending on the size of the team you're writing something for, you can't get around. When I was at Oracle, within the Marketing Cloud business unit, where I ran product marketing, we had hundreds of sellers. More broadly, though, our stuff was being accessed by the larger Oracle customer experience Salesforce, which numbered in the thousands. I mean, still to this day, some of the largest audiences I've ever spoken in front of is an internal audience at Oracle. So when I look at that type of presentation, I actually think some judicious use of text on the screen is important. It's important for two reasons. One is, and this will sound a little skeptical, you're just not going to bat a thousand with all of your seller's ability to grok every single thing that you've conveyed in a presentation and carry that forward externally. And so knowing that that is going to happen, you then need to think about the medium. And the medium in this case is either, if it's virtually, it's going to be over a screen on Zoom, or it's going to be in a conference room. And what I learned to kind of figure out is these are the two or three slides, say over a 8 to 10 slide presentation, that clearly someone's going to ask a question about and are going to just hang and sit there on the screen or on a Zoom for some period of time. And I feel like a lot of marketers, to be honest, they get so up their own ass about their craft and what they do and like, oh, that's too much text on a slide. And it's like, there is some level of pragmatism that you have to have when you're building for a different audience. And I haven't even always gotten that perfect. You know, I think there's been presentations that I've put out there that candidly, now that we have this ability to have call recordings where we go and see sales deliver something, if I look in one of the top sellers that I really respect and believe can carry forward a lot of messages is struggling to deliver it in a compelling way, then I know that I might have built something that was a little too unique to me and not broadly applicable to everyone else.
That's a totally different mindset. I love that because it does go against everything on LinkedIn that you see about, you know, never have bullets on the slide. And as you, I think you put a little more nuance to that. I think a teammate and I were talking about bowling with kids. If you take kids bowling, they're going to be like pretty pissed because they're always going to hit that gutter. But if you take them to the neon bowling with, you know, the gutter guards and the bumpers, they're going to have a blast. And I feel like the right amount of bullets are those bumper guards. They're going to hit some pins. They're probably going to get some strikes, right? But it just keeps things maybe a little more cohesive and aligned when you're trying to scale a message. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the importance of the product demo within like the funnel these days. Has it shifted over time? Just curious, you know, the importance you put on the demo.
I think it has become even more important over the last few years for a few reasons. One is, if you look at the B2B buying process or really any kind of considered purchase where a larger sum of money is getting transacted between two entities, either a consumer and a business or a business and a business, the buyer in that context has done an inordinate amount of research even ahead of engaging with the brand. And so knowing that, I think that customers today have a bigger bullshit detector than they probably did even 10 years ago, because they've already done so much research. I think there's a lot of sellers, particularly ones that I know from like the late 90s, early 2000s, that are like, oh, it's all about the value sell and blah, 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 which is like kind of a long-winded way of saying like, you know, how do you snowball a customer a little bit into, don't look over here, I just want to talk about these things over here. And I think customers are just way smarter than that. They want to see your products and they want to understand what it can do for them and can it meet their requirements. Now, my point of view is that's great. Customers should absolutely be able to see the product, see it demonstrated. However, I do feel like a lot of companies don't give their product its proper due by not putting more narrative around what it can enable and what it can do for the customer. I think if you reduce a product demo down to a point and click experience where you're just going blow by blow, feature by feature through everything, at a certain point, I mean, that's what an RFP is for. Like, send over the Excel sheet and we'll say yes, no, with different explanations as to what a product can do. But I think when you can show what is truly possible, when you get into more of those art of the possible demos, I think it really inspires the customer to think differently about their project or whatever it is they're trying to execute. Mm-hmm. And honestly, they'll be forgiving of you if it actually doesn't hit 100% of their needs in that demo. I think mm-hmm. they appreciate if you can paint a vision around what's possible. Because that's the last thing I'd say about it is I do think teams get really focused, and this is because of the sales methodologies that get pressed into these organizations. They get very focused on wanting confirmation bias. Is this hitting everything you want? Is this have everything you need? Like, do we cover everything? And while that sounds very customer-centric, it's actually oddly more just self-serving for them, edifying a process mm-hmm. versus really delighting the customer or the buyer in a way that's interesting. So I think demos are super important.
Okay. And I like your phrasing, like art of the possible, you know, and I know there's like this shift to like product-led growth, PLG, and I'm sort of in the market for project management tools, right? And a lot of them point me toward signing up for a free trial, and that's their version of the demo. And then I'm in this sort of barren environment that the data is like, doesn't really make any sense to me because it's not very relevant to what I'm trying to use it for. And I click around for 2 weeks, like one day, and I feel like that is the lack. It's like the other side of it. It's cool. Like I can see that I can actually interact with the product, but there's absolutely zero narrative. And maybe there's some tool tips that can kind of tell me like, hey, you could do this, but I still feel like it lacks that narrative component. But when you mentioned that, it reminded me of that early Oracle Marketing Cloud massive product keynote. We were involved in a couple of them, but you used this term and we were working with two phenomenal, you know, speakers, John Stedick and Steve Krause, amazing product leaders and visionaries, I'd say, great storytellers. But y'all were talking about user vignettes. And I think you can talk a little bit more about this, but Oracle Marketing Cloud had several products to showcase just in an hour-long keynote. And I think there was a lot of talking with different product leaders, how do we prioritize which features? And I love the way that you packaged it up together in a sort of like a long story with all these mini, you know, stories baked in. So do you remember that and what all went into it?
I remember it very well. And I think that one of the things when we started that project was I was very against just doing point and click demos on stage. I think that it makes an audience's eyes glaze over. I think that's when you see the phones start coming out and people starting to split their attention elsewhere. I also feel that so much can go wrong on doing a product demo, point and click, main stage, for reasons that are not the fault of your product, right? If something flakes out on stage, everyone wants to say, oh, well, is there something wrong with your product? It hung there and it didn't work. But you're dealing with event Wi-Fi, you're dealing with a lot of different connections to these different screens you're working with up front. And what I wanted to do was sort of minimize the level of risk involved on stage for our presenters. I think the other thing, though, is that by making that decision, I also pretty much created 1,000% more work for everyone up front. Because when you're doing a point and click demo and you're a product person who knows that product super well, yes, you have to prepare, but you live in that product so much that you kind of can just show up a little bit more. You have a general sense of what you want to walk through and you can kind of show up and do that demo versus. And just for the audience's edification, like the way we did these ones was there was a story narrative that was primarily driven via slides. And then we actually recorded little 30 to 45 second snippets of things that were happening with the product and presented that on stage. But once you activated that video within the context of the presentation, the speaker had to speak to it and move exactly at the same rate that the mouse was moving across. And so it was an enormous amount of work to ask like two SVPs of product at the time to go and do. You're right. We had a unique working situation with just two amazing product leaders that liked this stuff as well. Mm-hmm. I could have seen it going a very different way had we worked with someone else. But that was a huge decision that we made up front around that, that, yeah, created a lot more work up front. The other thing that when we sat down to write it, and I remember when I first took pen to paper with some of the storytelling for it, I said to myself, okay, I have these 10 different products or whatever it was at the time that we have to think through and work through. I'll pragmatically try to keep those in the back of my mind as I write, but right now I don't want to burden myself too much with what the products can or can't do. I just want to write a really good story that I think is interesting and relatable to the people in the audience. So we did that. And then we pulled in product and sales engineers and other people who said, well, Chris, the product can't really do that, but if you change the story to do this, we could go in that direction. So the other cool part of it is, though it did create more work, it liberated us in the storytelling process in a way that I'm not sure we would have had available to us at the time.
Right. For me, designing on that side, it was a blast because we got to come up with like a fake brand that suited, you know, the storyline.
Point Electronics.
Yeah. Well, and then Durham Denim was one as well, right?
Yeah.
And we, yeah, so like got to blow out all these fake assets, fake websites, fake, you know, email newsletters and stuff, and then tailor it. And the other mechanism I liked from your story, as you're, you know, you're always asking like what's in it for the audience. I remember these slides that would have the persona both of a marketer and then of their customer. So it had like dual what's in it for me, you know, because you addressed both, all right, here's the day in the life of you, marketer, who's in the crowd, and then here's what's in it for your end customer. So that was sort of like next level what's in it for me, because you were truly thinking about their job to be done, and their job to be done is like, I got to be super personalized for my customers and I got to make them happy. And so did you get any feedback? Like, do you remember if that was successful or not?
Yeah, the feedback from those presentations were significantly positive and frankly were, I think, kind of a game changer for my career. That presentation in particular, the first one we ever did, you know, at the time I had been hired into a head of product marketing role at Oracle, and I was swimming with sharks over there. I mean, there were, guarantee you, a laundry list of a bunch of guys and ladies in their 50s who would have loved to have had that job. I was like 29 or 30. I was there because of a belief the GM of that business unit, Kevin Aykroyd, had in me, where he brought me on and he told people, you might think he's a couple shoe sizes too small, but just wait. And for me, I think that the delivery of that ended up being a massive thing around Oracle, because no one had really done a presentation demo in that format before. And having the opportunity to lead the team that was doing that, I think, created a level of organizational credibility for me that then allowed me to do a lot of the stuff that we ended up doing in our partnership with Ghost Ranch there. You know, when we think about me being able to shake down budget for presentations, being able to do this type of investment in stuff where at Oracle, that was not the muscle memory. The muscle memory was, well, let me just show a graphic of the Magic Quadrant where we, Oracle, appears up and to the right, mic drop, end of presentation, you want to buy from us, right? And I think in some areas of the hardware business, that probably worked for them. But in software as a service, getting into cloud-based applications, I think it was a rude awakening for Oracle that, oh, wait a minute, we're going into a meeting room that Adobe and Salesforce both just came out of. Ever been to a Dreamforce or an Adobe event? Yeah, Adobe, they may know something about presentations and making them look good. So I think it was like eye-opening to them that a presentation like that could work, and that also investment in PowerPoint storytelling was relevant. And for me, I always tell people, they said, what did you think your greatest accomplishment was at Oracle? And I have a number of different things I'm proud of within the context of the business unit I worked in. But my biggest thing that I hung my hat on is, like, by the time I left, if I went into other areas of our intranet where other business units posted all of their sales collateral, to see decks that were posted there that clearly had been a take one of the ones from our business unit, save it, save as a new version, and then fill in just their product and their content pieces into that. To me, that like created a groundswell of change within Oracle in terms of how they looked at storytelling and presentations. And I don't know how long that's lasted there, because it is such an engineering and product-centric mm-hmm. culture. But to me, that was like one of the things I was most proud of.
And I think you ended up taking that fervor for storytelling and a more creative approach to, I guess, sales enablement. But I think when you went to Cision and then, you know, you had that chief marketing officer opportunity, I think you took that day in the life demo kind of idea and actually kind of salesified it. Is that right?
Yeah. So I wanted to figure out a way to release those vignettes that sellers could actually go and use them in a meeting. And that was a different type of enablement challenge, because in that case, you had to operate with some level of constraint at the top of your mind. You had to sort of be realistic that, hey, it's probably unrealistic that, you know, people in your field organization are going to be able to properly memorize a 20 to 30 minute demo flow. The other challenge around doing it was we had to create like different breaks available for discussion, because when you're selling this in a sales meeting, customers are not going to be as docile actually as an audience, where there's an acceptance of you standing up on a stage and them sitting there and consuming things from you. It's different when you're on a more level playing field of a meeting room. So yeah, we started doing it because what I felt when I looked at what was happening in the field was that our demos were just, a lot of them were real snoozers. Like they just were boring. And I felt like we needed to have that storytelling element available to them to use. So yeah, being able to release those into the field, we focused on, you know, keeping them a reasonable length. And then we also partnered closely with our sales enablement team to make sure that the tools were available for a rep that really wanted to learn this, commit it to memory, and to bring it forward. But yeah, that was a super cool thing to do. And, you know, again, it's one where there needs to be some organizational commitment to doing it from sales leadership, because I think if there's not, it is a lot of work. It's some work up front, even when we shorten them to go in and do in a meeting.
Yeah. When you say reasonable length, is that like no more than maybe 5 minutes?
I think 5 minutes is good. Yeah. 5 minutes would be like the gold standard. And the way that we sort of thought about it is like, hey, why don't you say, I'm going to do this 5 minute vignette. I'm going to share it with you. I'm probably going to go a little bit without questions just to move through it. Then we have a live instance of our product ready in the browser. We can go then drill into different things that you want. And that was also really important to me, because I think there was a tendency to feel like, well, if they're recording some vignettes into these demos and doing them that way, are they faking something? Mm-hmm. And we weren't faking anything. It was just that telling them within the context of this story narrative, you have to keep moving. You have to move at a pace to make that story interesting. Mm-hmm.
And Chris, now that you're sort of at the top of the marketing chain, as you reflect back for those PMMs tuning in who want to take it to the next level, what do you think it is that separates the good PMMs from the great ones?
So I think good product marketers have command of their product, their buyer persona, all of the different things that they write about in all the books. I think there's a reason that we talk about the importance of persona development. There's a reason we talk about understanding pricing and packaging really well. There's a reason we talk about the importance of strong positioning that both the marketing team that you're maybe in, if you sit within marketing or even in products, and the sales organization can carry something forward. So I think being able to do all those things competently is, by the way, not easy. I actually think there's only some portion of product marketers that are able to do those things very well. But I think if you're able to do those things well and competently, you can have a very good career in product marketing. I think the product marketers that end up being great are the ones where all of those projects are memorable and they also have something memorable or interesting to say. I look at so many different product categories, right? I work in software, but in many cases, it's similar in other mature categories where there are so many different products that more or less can do something similar for a customer in a market. So at that point, it really comes down to, do you have some type of insight or idea on top of that that really is compelling to a customer and really makes them want to do business with you? And I think the great product marketers are at the heart of figuring out what that one thing is. And yes, in certain cases, it's not going to be them who carries it forward in the market. That's going to be a seller, as an example. But you have to come up with some type of insight or idea that compels someone to be inspired to want to do something differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like what a lot of marketing and sales is typically missing still. I think there's sort of this go through the motions of building something serviceable, doing a meeting where you convey that stuff. And like I said, it's not bad, but you could swap your company logo out for four other company logos in your space and no one would know the difference. Our product marketing team at MindTickle, I call it my homeroom because, you know, in school, like you go around to all your different classrooms, and I still call product marketing like my homeroom. And I will tell them all the time, strive to be original and strive to come up with an insight that you feel like no one else is doing right now. Mm-hmm. Because if you can do that, I think that is what separates the great product marketers, is that then has massive organizational impact on everything from how your sellers go out into the market, how your executives talk about your products, mm-hmm. how analysts really consume what you're doing. So that to me is the big one, is originality.
That's awesome. Yeah, total X factor stuff. And speaking of MindTickle, yeah, what's going on over there? What are you excited for in 2023?
Absolutely. So, you know, for your audience's edification, MindTickle is a revenue enablement platform, and we've been very focused on essentially how do you make your sellers maximize their productivity and their potential out in market. It's a very complex problem. It's been made more complex by some of the economic headwinds that have existed in the market over the last 3 to 6 months for a number of companies, because typically a lot of companies will hire salespeople on the path to making their number. They'll accept lower levels of productivity through a portion of their sales team as long as those top performers are sort of picking up the slack for everyone else. Well, when you don't have the ability to hire at the same clip, suddenly that lever is not really available. And you have to figure out, how do you maximize the most productivity you can get out of each and every seller? And it's funny because I think companies would say they're trying to do that all the time, but I think sometimes hitting your revenue numbers can be a good cologne for a lot of things that don't smell great within your organization. And I think now we're starting to see that with a number of companies that we talk with, where they're saying, hey, it is not acceptable for us to have this massive portion of our sales force not attaining their quota. Can you help us with this? So we've been very focused on not just how you train up and provide content to sellers. I think that in a lot of ways is table stakes. And certainly in our space, from a functionality standpoint, that's really table stakes. What we're trying to very much focus on is, how do you come up with a more data-driven or scientific recipe for what good looks like for each one of your sellers? What are the attributes and behaviors that you feel like they need to exude in market to perform and do well? So you'll see this year, we're going to focus a lot on more analysis-oriented products that help revenue leaders get in there and sort of understand, hey, this cohort of sellers, I noticed these three folks are going to hit their number. These three folks are 30% off, and these three folks probably aren't. Mm-hmm. And really what we're interested in with our customer is, frankly, that middling cohort. How many of them can you push up into that top level of performance? And so that's where we're focused a lot right now from an innovation perspective. And I think it's a really interesting time for B2B sales and marketing organizations, because all of everyone, whether you work in marketing, sales enablement, sales management, revenue operations, sales operations, all of these people are in the orbit of a seller. And in a lot of cases, we all just get in their way. Marketing comes at them and says, ah, I got this new deck that I just made, or I got this new piece of content. Sales enablement says, hey, look, I have a new enablement calendar that is going to solve X, Y, and Z problems for you. Sales ops says, hey, I've looked at the forecast and I think that, you know, we can, you know, hit this number in Q2. But what we find is that all of those premises are either very anecdotal, or the data that companies leverage is very short-sighted. Mm-hmm. Like when most of these companies do a sales forecast, they're just looking at all their deals. And now they're starting to apply AI and, you know, other stuff on top of those deals to sort of get a line of sight into how they expect to perform. But what they don't realize is that, well, should you actually, is a critical data point the people you have working on this deal and what skill sets they have and what behaviors that they're exhibiting in market? Wouldn't you want to consider that as part of your forecast? So it's some pretty heady stuff. It's interesting. I'm very excited for like the next phase that we're headed into right now.
And yeah.
I would also just say for me personally, MindTickle's been a great company to work at because I built some compelling content and presentations, but I've also realized they're only as good as the field organization's ability to carry them forward.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was a real compelling reason to come and work at MindTickle in the first place, because I had lived the challenge.
Right. Yeah. You're as deep in it as you can get. And yeah, some incredible insights you're taking away. It's fun. Chris, most important question, you know, product marketing insiders are dying to know, what is your walkout music?
Tweezer Reprise by Phish. I'm a huge Phish fan.
Yes.
So,
of a good buildup, right?
Yeah, yeah. That song always gets me going.
Oh, I think a lot of people too. That's great. I love it. Okay, Chris, any parting shots? Any final words of wisdom?
I think that for your audience, if you're in product marketing, I still believe, even through all the changes that have happened in business over the past decade, it is still the most fun area of the business to work in. You get to sit at this amazing cross section of, you know, the more back end stuff around product development and engineering, and then the front end stuff of selling and marketing the product. So I think you're in an incredible area, and I think we need to continue to nurture the profession and have as many great product marketers as we can.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing. Good luck with the rest of 2023, and hope to talk again soon, Chris.
All right. Thanks, Mikey.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Product Marketing Insider podcast. Remember, we have an extensive back catalog of episodes waiting to be explored, as well as dedicated series focusing on core product marketing areas such as storytelling, go-to-market, leadership, sales enablement, competitive intelligence, and much more. For the full selection, head to www.productmarketingalliance.com/podcasts.